In this section, we've started talking about orthopara versus meta directors, correct?
Yes.
And we did all those different resonance structures to demonstrate why is it that something like phenol that has a lone pair that can undergo resonance, how that causes orthopara substitution, and how something like a nitrile group that withdraws electron density would put a bad charge combination on the ring, how that effectively ends up causing meta substitution. Did we, in this section, discuss why or what activators are versus deactivators?
No.
No, we did not. So let's look at a generalized electrophilic addition again. And actually, let's do two reactions in parallel. So let's take plain old benzene and... let's make it a nitration reaction. Why not? So nitration, we have both nitric and sulfuric acids. Sulfuric acid protonates the nitric acid, ends up making that really reactive NO2 plus, which the benzene ring then attacks, and then we reform the aromatic ring. Let's do the same reaction with phenol. And technically, we would get two products out. And if I hadn't mentioned this before, I'll say it now. You do not have to worry at this level of O-chem about predicting how much ortho versus para that you're going to get. You need to know that this is an ortho-para director, but you don't have to try to predict percentage of the mixture that you're going to end up with. On a synthesis problem, you can just ignore the fact that you get two different products. So I'll just arbitrarily choose the para one in this case. Now, for this first one, let me go back and expand to write a mechanism. And I'm going to ignore the formation of the NO2. Part of the reason I want to do this is because I think the last time in this section I did it, I forgot to mention about nitrogen and one very important arrow that I may have left out, where when it attacks, you must show one of the double bonds going to nitrogen opening up, because nitrogen can only have four bonds to it. I did go back and fix that. Okay. Well, just to make sure, because it's a common mistake that shows up when I put this problem on the exam. I keep doing that. No, I keep drawing my benzene ring, and you know, if it's benzene's reacted, it's not quite benzene anymore. So, remember that where the nucleophile ends up, that is where the hydrogen is, that's going to get eliminated because it's the other position that ends up with the plus charge. So something comes along, I'll call it B for generalized base, removes that hydrogen, and we end up forming the benzene ring. So from the perspective of benzene, this is a two-step reaction. Yes, there's the steps before where we make the NO2 species. But if we ignore that, if we look only at benzene, let's see if we can draw a reaction coordinate diagram for that reaction. I'll call the first one with benzene reaction A, and I'll call the second one with phenol reaction B. So reaction A, we'd have this kind of reaction coordinate diagram. The reaction, let's presume, is exothermic. And there is going to be one intermediate to this reaction. And in fact, let me move this line lower just so I can leave myself room. All right? Because the intermediate should be at much higher energy, shouldn't it? Because we're breaking the aromaticity of the benzene ring. That's the whole reason why benzene's not reactive in most alkene reactions anyways. And in fact, that's the whole point of that hydrogenation discussion that we had, where we looked at a single double bond versus what would happen in theory if we had two double bonds versus three, and we saw that in benzene that it was so much more stable compared to the three double bonds, and we said that's because of aromaticity. Well, all that stability, you'd have to add all that energy in order to break apart the benzene ring. So the intermediate's going to be at a much higher energy. So here's benzene, the intermediate. And then the product. Now let's draw in parallel just a portion of the reaction coordinate diagram for reaction B. I'm going to place phenol arbitrarily at the same energy as benzene is. Now, they are not at the same energy, though, because they're not isomers. So if you wanted to be technical about it, we could look at heats of formation and figure out on a more absolute scale where energetically these two compounds would lie. But let's not even worry about that. Let's just talk about what would the effect of the phenol lone pair be on getting to that intermediate. Because, that, as I said a moment ago, breaking benzene apart, that's the rate-limiting step of the reaction. And just so we can have a proper-looking diagram, let me put these in. So I'll call this EA1 for the first reaction. Not maybe, I'll just do it like this. EAA, meaning for reaction A. And if I write RLS, will everybody remember that means rate limiting step? Since that wasn't an automatic yes. No, because I don't want you to be confused later on, so. That's the rate-limiting step. Why is it the rate-limiting step? Because it's got the largest activation barrier. Because for benzene to be reformed, that's trivial. It wants to be reformed. That's not going to be a tough transition state to get to. But to break benzene open, that's a huge barrier. But what about phenol? It's got this lone pair that is adding electron density to the benzene ring. The whole difficulty with the reaction is to break open the benzene ring. But if you're providing it electron density, that's exactly the electron density it needs to go out and attack that electrophile to start the process. Another way of saying it is that once you did have that attack occur and you did end up with the positive charge, anything that could delocalize that positive charge is going to make it energetically more favorable. Well, energetically more favorable means that by comparison, if we look at the magnitude of the activation energies that we're going to end up with, we're going to have a relatively smaller activation energy. So, due to electron density being donated by the substituent on phenol, the activation energy to reach the intermediate which we call that EAB, the one with phenol, is lower than in the similar reaction with unsubstituted benzene. Which, that's what I called EAA. Since the electron density from phenol is stabilizing the carbocation and making the attack on the electrophile easier. And then if we were to look at the Arrhenius expression, we would say that the lower activation energy ends up causing a higher rate. And so that's how we end up calling things like phenol activators. It's an activator because it speeds up the rate of reaction. Now, hopefully you have all begun reading these sections. So let me ask the question. Is an orthoparadirector always an activator? No. And let me lead us there. Why not? Because oxygen, it has this lone pair, it delocalizes. That's what's stabilizing this compound. But isn't oxygen the second most electronegative element on the periodic table? And in so many other situations, we talk about oxygen being an electron withdrawing group. If we were in NMR right now, we'd be talking about how it would cause large chemical shift. If we were talking about pKa values, like we did last quarter, we would say heteroatoms like oxygen make hydrogen dissociation easier because they're pulling electron density away from the hydrogen. So if we had those, and those are just two examples, but if we had those two examples of oxygen acting as electron withdrawer, then how come it's an activator here? The answer is it gives more than it takes. Oxygen has good orbital overlap with carbon, and so the resonance that oxygen undergoes provides a good amount of electron density. It really does activate the reaction. Yes, it's electronegative, so it is pulling some electron density away, but it donates more than it withdraws. And so overall, oxygen-type groups like this are activators. And let me write that up. Even though oxygen is electronegative, and will withdraw electron density by induction, it also has good orbital overlap with carbon, and it provides more electron density through delocalization than it withdraws by induction. Yes. So if we have a p orbital in oxygen, a p orbital in carbon, if we imagine that that's how the delocalization is occurring, the size of those p orbitals is enough the same that they get as much overlap as they could, or at least a similar amount of overlap as you would have in a carbon-carbon double bond. Carbon-carbon, they're exactly the same atoms, so their orbitals are going to overlap the best. if, as we're about to get to, the halogens, if you have something like bromine, much bigger atom, the orbital is a much bigger shape on the bromine. And so percentage-wise, as far as how much it overlaps with the carbon's orbitals, there's a mismatch there in size. The overlap occurs, you still have delocalization, but it's not as favorable because there's not as much chance for those atoms to interact. And that's exactly why something like chlorine or bromine is an orthopara-director. It still does those resonance structures, but it doesn't do so as well in terms of how much electron density it's providing. And I won't draw it in on here, but imagine that we had another graph where we had an electron withdrawing group. Ignoring whether orthoparameta is going to form, pulling electron density off this ring is going to increase the activation energy. If you're increasing activation energy, it's going to slow the reaction down. And so there's two different effects. Delocalization places more electron density at certain places in the molecule. And that's why orthopara versus meta substitution occurs. Separately, as far as the rate of reaction, more electron density is being pulled away than provided. It's being provided, though, in just specific places. So the specific places, again, that explains the substitution pattern, the regiochemistry. But how the fact that it overall is pulling electron density away, that's why it slows the reaction down, and halogens are known as deactivating orthopara directors. So let me write this down about chlorine, because fluorine's got a slightly different story.
Can you draw a small diagram to actually see why it's more like electrodominated?
I'll do a picture like this. So here's a carbon-oxygen versus carbon-chlorine double bond. You might pause and say, wait, chlorine double bond, it doesn't want to form double bonds. But remember, this is in a resonance structure. And just to give us a reminder of that, in fact, let's say that we have some electrophilic reaction that had occurred. And we had a chlorine on there initially. And so one resonance structure that's possible which shows delocalization using chlorine, but it would make a double bond technically out of the chlorine. We would have the same thing with oxygen present, so I guess I'll only write the resonance structure set once. But this is why we're going to look at a carbon-oxygen double bond versus a carbon-chlorine double bond. Chlorine, larger atom, larger orbitals. And we can see that that causes a less favorable overlap with carbon. Because, yeah, carbon's small, but therefore its overlap, its orbital doesn't fully overlap with chlorine. Percentage of overlap is related to bond strength and the ability to delocalize. So there's a poor overlap due to mismatch in orbital size. Where carbon and oxygen, they're more similar, so better overlap because they're similar in size. Does that help? And that's kind of directed at everybody. Does that help make the situation a little more clear about this orbital overlap aspect? So let me go back and tell the story about chlorine again. So for chlorine, or let me make this general statement first. Halogens are orthopara-directors, but are deactivators. Resonance involving the halogen will always put more electron density. At the ortho and para positions. Because here's another delocalization we could write. And this is not a reaction mechanism. It's a justification of the statement I just made. Because let's say we had something like chlorobenzene. And even before reaction, realize, on paper at least, we could write this resonance structure. It's a horrible resonance structure. We took a compound that was neutral and we created a split ion out of it. But notice that that negative charge is going to be at the ortho position. And if I wrote one more resonance structure, I could show it skips over the meta position and it ends up at para instead. So this is why, regardless of their activating and deactivating capability, halogens are always orthopara directors. But a separate issue is, let me write that down. Or let me add that to this. Resonance involving the halogen will always put more electron density at the orthopara positions, regardless of the overall activating or deactivating effect of the halogen. Now, if we have chlorine, bromine, and iodine, these atoms are large, and so they have poor orbital overlap. They're not as electronegative as fluorine, but they are more electronegative. They withdraw more electron density due to induction than they do provide back through resonance. Since halogens, these chlorine, bromine, iodine at least, are larger than carbon, they have poor orbital overlap, so they don't provide as much electron density as they withdraw due to induction, so they are deactivators. And then in case of fluorine, it's only a little different than the size of... Did I just fail Chem 1A? That's embarrassing. Because isn't oxygen smaller than carbon? Because doesn't atomic size contract as you go from left to right on the periodic table? Yeah. So Dr. Gray has to go back to teach Chem 1A again so I don't forget these types of things. Point is still the same. Carbon and oxygen, they're similar enough in size that they still have good overlap. That's actually the same story for fluorine. It is similar enough in size to carbon that it has good overlap. But it's the most electronegative element on the periodic table. So it again withdraws more than it donates. So we have three classifications of substituents. We have ortho-paradirectors. Versus meta-directors. And we have activators. Versus deactivators. Did we go through a list of example orthopara directors at all? We didn't. Okay, so let me do this on the next page because you need to see specific examples. So we only talked about phenol and nitrobenzene the other day, and that was it. Why don't I look at my own notes and I can answer that question? Now let me look what we did so I know what we've got to cover. Let's see. Last day we had real lecture. Would have been the 5th. So we did Friedel-Crafts, we did ortho, metaparo, oh, but we did get furan and thiophene. Okay. But no, we didn't talk about any examples. Okay, good. Because we have the time to do that right now. So let me recopy. Yeah, because it's going to end up on separate pages. When I scan the notes, I will copy and paste what I just drew here on this next page. So just picking right up. Ortho-paradirectors. Those would be things like what? What are some good ortho-paradirectors? Mm-hmm. Phenol, of course.
Aniline.
Did I teach you all the structure of aniline?
Yeah.
Yes, okay. Someone said another one?
Anisole,
right? So in other words, we have alcohols, amines, ethers. What other functional groups? Okay, halogens, though, they are ortho-paradirectors, but I'm going to put them in this other category, that they are deactivators. They are the only functional group that you're going to learn that is a deactivator. So let's go back to the activating orthoparagroups. Styrene. Alkenes. What other groups? Well, thiols, if alcohols work. How about toluene? Well, because you're not going to have delocalization or conjugation, but what could you have? Hyperconjugation. And that hyperconjugation is enough of effect that it does make an alkyl group an activator. So it's orthoparadirector and activator due to hyperconjugation. So let's go over to the other column, which you can't see the top anymore. So we're supposed to be talking about deactivators that are meta-directors. So I'll do this one for you since you will get there first. Nitro group, which was our example the other day. How about some other examples of meta-directors? What are some other functional groups that withdraw electron density? What functional group in NMR land have we been talking about that withdraws electron density? Carbonyls. So benzaldehyde or other aldehydes. Or we could have acetophenone or other ketones. Of course, there's all sorts of functional groups with carbonyls in them. For example, methyl benzoate, an ester. We still have a carbonyl, and why are these electron withdrawing groups? Because the carbonyl's carbon is very delta positive. That's going to do exactly the same thing as the nitro would do. Even if it's not a real positive, it would put a delta positive next to the ring, where that position right next to the ring wouldn't want to form a positive charge. Would all esters be would all esters be meta-directors? Would they all be deactivators? No? Why not? Because you knew that it would have to be no, because otherwise the story is boring, right? It depends on what? Ooh, you're right. Could you explain that, though? You're on the right track. What if we did this? That's an ester, isn't it? But now the oxygen is next to the benzene ring. The carbonyl will pull electron density away. This is not as good an activator as having an ether or an alcohol. But because you do have that lone pair there, it is able to delocalize. It is an orthopara director. This is not really the correct use of the phrase, per se, but this gets the idea across. Since we haven't covered esters, that's a 12C topic. I'll just use this phrase for the moment. Reverse ester, or phenolic ester, is the better phrase. Phenol, phenolic, that's where that word comes from. So a phenol, or phenol, is a common enough functional group. It's got its own adjective. Can we think of any other electron withdrawing groups? Sulfonate, good. And same situation, as long as it's the sulfur connected to the benzene ring, then it's a deactivator. Now, does anybody have their text with them? I would just want to see if there's any other really major ones that they mentioned, the text mentions, just so I don't leave anything out of the list. Okay, so your table is on page 669. Is this the international edition?
No.
They're the same page numbers anyways, though, aren't they? Ah, there's one more. And again, this one I might not have thought of because it's a 12C functional group, a nitrile. So when you have, it looks like cyanide, but except it's not an ionic. When you have it connected to another carbon, it's a carbon functional group, so it's a nitrile. So let me summarize what we've talked about so far today. We have orthopara directors, which hopefully you all were able to start working on the resonance structures to understand why something's ortho versus para. Since I did this with the other section, I'll do this with you. It is one of the questions on exam 3. It's so obvious, though, that it's one of the questions on exam 3. I'm comfortable telling you that because it's this big, nasty mechanism thing that beautifully explains why we get the substitution patterns that we do. You'll then be asked, what's the difference between something being an orthopara or metadirector and it being an activator and deactivator? So you have to understand that there's this distinction. Resonance has to do with what's happening with the lone pairs, regardless of whether overall the lone pair is being given or taken. So resonance is still going to cause electrons density to show up in certain places. As a separate issue, some things donate electron density, some things withdraw electron density. Those that donate are activators, those that withdraw are deactivators. And normally, since providing electrons through resonance is giving electron density, orthopara directors are normally activators. Since functional groups that would deactivate the ring do so by withdrawing electron density, which also usually means the functional group's got a real positive or delta positive right where the benzene ring connects, that will also cause it be a metadirector. But then there's the halogens that are in this in-between space. They give electron density through resonance, so they're orthopara directors, but they induct more electron density than they give, and so they are deactivators. And then we have our array of example orthopara activating directors, deactivating directors, and metadirectors. There is no example that I know of. Doesn't mean it doesn't exist. I'm sure someone's figured out somehow how to do it. But there are none that I know of, no meta directors that are activators. So for this class, you're safe that if you know it's meta, it's deactivating. Questions? Yes? Can may I pull it up? Sure.
No. Yeah.
Oh, the heading.
Yeah.
From left to right, it's orthopara activator, orthopara deactivator, and then meta director, which is also a deactivator. Now, we don't have a heck of a lot of time left, but I'm going to give you this bit of advice, again, that I also gave section 3. We are supposed to be talking about synthesis at this point. We're supposed to be talking about aromatic synthesis. But because we've been so heavily involved in theory, and because I do need to get around to the Diels-Alder reaction, I'm going to start on a topic that I don't know yet whether it's going to be on the exam. My initial impression is maybe we won't get through it quite in time, and maybe it won't be. You don't want to act that way. Mainly the reason that it might not be is because, well, we won't finish talking about this until Wednesday. And even though I have given topics before that said, you had to know this for the exam, I got so much other stuff to ask you. If I wait till the final to ask it, I'm okay with that. But our next subject that we're going to cover before we complete talking about synthesis is frontier orbital chemistry. And specifically, we're going to get into a type of reaction called a pericyclic reaction. So if you look at our syllabus, I think it's maybe next week's topic that I'm working on now. It's one that's scheduled for the quarter. I'm just doing a little topic swap because the same types of pictures we've been drawing for molecular orbitals, we need to do here. Because here's the story that we're going to discuss on Wednesday. Is this starting material that I drew aromatic? No, obviously not, because it's not cyclic. And you might have been tempted to wonder just because it does have the right number of double bonds. But because it's not a ring, it's not aromatic. But you could imagine, even though it doesn't have that bridge, you could say, making it the ring, that one p orbital on one side of that gap may still want to interact with another p orbital on the other side of the gap. And in fact, that ends up being the case. This reaction undergoes a mechanism where we could write it like this. One of the double bonds from one side attacks the double bond on the other side, which pushes that double bond over, which pushes that double bond over. So notice that this is a cyclic mechanism. But it's not a true ring that it's happening in, and so that's why it's called a pericyclic reaction. The end product, then, is a diene. And I've done this reaction twice, because in one case, we're going to discuss if just heat is used to cause the reaction to occur, versus if light causes the reaction to occur. Now, why are we talking about these at two different reaction conditions? Because one of the products is optically active and one of them is not. Which one is which? Now, I know it's a 12A question, but left one is? Not active, right? It's meso. The other one is optically active. Why is there this difference in reactivity? Well, we are going to get into a discussion of ground versus excited states. In fact, let me get to that part of it today, because the rest of this is going to be in a molecular orbital description, which is going to take us a while to write all these orbitals out. So, can someone refresh my memory, tell me what the three filling rules are for electrons in orbitals? Lowest energy up, which one is that? The Alpha-Bau principle? How about another one? No two electrons can have the same four quantum numbers, which what's another way of expressing the same rule? That if you have two electrons in an orbital, that's possible, but only if they have opposite spin. That's the Pauli exclusion principle. And then what's the third one? Hund's rule, which says what? That If you have a bunch of degenerate orbitals, which means they're all the same energy, that one electron goes into each before you pair the electrons up. So you maximize spin is another way of expressing that. That's all true only in one situation, the one we call the ground state. So the ground, and implicit in that is the ground electronic state, which is the lowest energy electron configuration. So imagine that I have some system that has four molecular orbitals to it. Could be something like the butadiene system. And notice the note over here, this is a random example. But one to show that electrons are filled according to the normal rules. I've put in the lowest energy levels first. There are no degenerate orbitals, so I don't worry about Hund's rule. And I paired electrons, but only after I had put one electron in. What if I hit it with a photon? My photon torpedoes. One electron can absorb that photon and jump up to a higher energy level. Of course, if you add the right energy, there's multiple levels that electron, in theory, could be bumped up to if there were multiple orbitals levels available, which there are in this case. But if I go up to the very next level, just to the next one, then this is what we call the first excited state. Because let's imagine that only one photon of the right amount of energy was absorbed. So that first excited state is the next lowest energy. Why do we care about whether a molecule is going to be in the ground or excited electronic states? Well, that's the difference between something being done with heat versus light. If you kept the reaction in the dark, then the electrons are going to be in one configuration. If you expose them to UV light, it's likely that at the moment a reaction occurs, or the way that enough energy is given so the reaction occurs, will be in this electronic state. What we're going to do on Wednesday is connect this to what the molecular orbitals look like, because the shape of the orbital is going to be different depending on where the electrons are going to be, or better way to put it, the most energetic electrons, the ones that act like valence electrons. Whatever orbital they're in, that's going to shape how the reaction occurs. That's what we'll do on Wednesday. Any last-minute questions before ending? Okay.